This is Health Matters. I'm Katie Natman. Each year, more than 500,000 women worldwide die as a result of pregnancy and childbirth from things like hemorrhage, infection and obstructed labour. And some diseases like malaria and HIV/AIDS can get worse in pregnancy. But not all of the risks for mothers and their babies are very well known.
It's a really tragic and absurd situation that you can have a baby born to a mother with HIV who was screened in pregnancy, treated with antiviral drugs, the baby is born free of HIV and then dies of syphilis.
Women who die in childbirth tend to die fairly quickly. And so you don't have the equivalent large group of people who are HIV positive who might be advocates for their own health care and for accessing better services. I think that when women die in childbirth, they tend to be forgotten.
For the first time this year, the World Health Report deals specifically with healthy motherhood and children. Una Campbell heads the Maternal Health Programme at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
Maternal health is one of the health indicators that shows the biggest difference between rich and poor countries. So that, for example, in some of the places with the lowest mortality, about 10 out of every 100,000 women will die. Whereas in countries that have higher mortality, for example, in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, you might have 1,500 per 100,000 women. And this is a huge difference. And it's compounded by the fact that women in many of these countries have more than one birth, and so they face this risk numerous times over their life. It's not just once or twice, but six, seven, eight times.
Or, in the case of my Ugandan grandmother, 19 times. My own mother only had me and my sister, which shows that attitudes to childbirth have changed. But what exactly is it that causes women to die in childbirth? The five big causes of mortality in childbirth are the same all over the world, but the ratios vary depending on where you are.
Women die of hemorrhage. They bleed to death. They die of hypertensive diseases of pregnancy, for example, eclampsia, where they fit. They die of obstructed labor, where the baby is stuck, perhaps because it's lying sideways or the woman's pelvis is too small. They die of infection, and they die of complications of unsafe induced abortion. These are similar to the reasons that women die, but perhaps the mix and proportion are different in more developed countries. Levels of mortality are very similar to the levels that you had in the UK, for example, in the 1930s and 1940s, before you had good medical interventions, antibiotics, safer cesarean sections.
But you don't have to give birth in hospital to reduce this level of death and injury. Una Campbell believes that just having someone around who knows what they're doing can vastly improve a woman's chances of survival.
One of the interesting pieces of work that we've been doing has been trying to look at poorer countries that have successfully reduced levels of maternal mortality to, say, around 100 per 100,000. And one of the big differences seems to be that it's settings where women have access to a skilled delivery attendant. And that is typically a midwife, but can also be a doctor who's conducting the delivery. And those deliveries in the settings that we've looked at, which include Malaysia in the 80s or Sri Lanka, Honduras, those attendants can either do the deliveries in the home or in a health center or in a hospital and still get quite good results. By contrast, some of the countries that have the highest mortality, women are typically delivering on their own or with relatives or with traditional birth attendants who don't really have the skills to manage the serious complications that kill women.
Preeclampsia is one of the biggest health threats to all pregnant women and their unborn babies. Annette Briley, research midwife at Tommy's Maternal and Fetal Research Unit, based at St Thomas's Hospital, is currently coordinating a trial looking at using vitamins to try to save the lives of women and their babies who are at risk from the disease.
A rise in blood pressure and protein in the mother's urine are the classic signs, and the third sign is actually swelling. But a lot of women do get swollen during pregnancy, especially during the summer or, you know, when the weather's hot. So on its own, that's not usually too much of a problem. But if the mother has rapid onset swelling, particularly around the face, so the features change, usually picked out by her family rather than the woman. But as I say, this is the reason why your blood pressure and your urine is checked at every antenatal appointment, is for the detection of preeclampsia.
Is it relatively easy to detect women who might be at risk?
We know that women expecting their first baby are particularly at risk. We know that if you're overweight, if you're expecting twins or triplets or more, if you have a pre-existing medical condition such as diabetes. But for a lot of women, preeclampsia just happens, and there's nothing women can really do, with the exception perhaps of losing weight before a pregnancy. There's nothing really women can do to stop it or prevent it from happening at this stage.
So if a woman is identified as having preeclampsia, what would happen to her body?
Basically, there's a lot known about preeclampsia, and there's still a lot to learn. We know that it's fundamentally involved with the way the placenta embeds. That actually happens around the 14th to 16th week of pregnancy, but obviously there's no sign at that stage. And basically, there's a failure of some of the cells to burrow right into the wall of the uterus. So therefore, the blood supply to the placenta is good, but it's not the very best it could be. For the baby, obviously the placenta isn't as well supplied as it could be. So the babies can tend to grow a little bit more slowly than if the mother's blood pressure is normal and preeclampsia doesn't exist. The only cure that we know to date is to deliver the placenta, and that obviously means delivering the baby. So therefore, the latest World Health Organization figures suggest that up to 25% of babies born early, that is because doctors want the baby born earlier, it's due to preeclampsia.
If I identified these women earlier, would it actually help to reduce the number of deaths of preeclampsia? Because the tests you're mentioning are quite simple, looking for protein in the urine, testing the blood pressure.
Yes, possibly. Currently, there's been some huge trials in aspirin. That certainly works for some women, but has not been the panacea that the early researchers hoped it would be for all women. The WHO also looked at calcium supplementation to prevent preeclampsia, and that was found to be very beneficial in developing countries where women were calcium deficient anyway, but actually didn't make a huge difference in industrialised countries. And we're currently looking at antioxidants in the forms of vitamin C and E in the prevention of preeclampsia, on the back of a small study that we did at St Thomas's, where we found that women who were identified as being at risk by a special scan looking at blood flow from them to their womb were 73% less likely to develop preeclampsia if they took the vitamins compared to a placebo arm. However, that sounds fantastic, but it was a very small study. We only had 283 women in, and it became very obvious that we needed to make sure that that was not just a fluke findings. And then the Wellcome Trust funded the multi-centre trial that's now nearing completion in the UK, and which the WHO are also recruiting in Peru, India, South Africa and Vietnam.
If you do manage to achieve the same kind of results, this would be a huge breakthrough, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the cost of the vitamins is about £10, just under £10 per pregnancy per woman. It would just be so simple.
Annette Briley on how a simple supplementation of vitamin C and E could help prevent preeclampsia. Another vitamin, this time A, has been linked with a reduction in childhood deaths. Una Campbell is one of the researchers looking at whether the same could apply to mother's health.
There was a very big study done in Nepal which aimed to look at whether giving women low-dose supplements would reduce early childhood deaths, say deaths in the neonatal period, and also whether it would improve maternal mortality. And much to everyone's surprise, or certainly much to the surprise of many of the people working in the maternal health field, this work in Nepal showed a 40% reduction in maternal mortality among people given vitamin A supplements. And again, this is one of those technological breakthroughs or sort of magic bullets that have many people quite excited. And there's now two large-scale studies trying to replicate this work, one in Bangladesh and one that the London School is involved with in Ghana with the Ministry of Health, the Ghanaian Ministry of Health's Health Research Center. We're only halfway through the study, so it's too early to tell. But if this is successful, I think it would become very useful to try to think of ways of fortifying foods with vitamin A.
The leading killer in developing countries is postpartum hemorrhage, where women bleed to death shortly after birth. Una Campbell again.
And when you talk to health workers and to families, this is perhaps one of the most distressing causes of death, because they really describe women just gushing blood. There is some promising work being done with a suit that's aimed at buying women time. It doesn't treat hemorrhage, but what it does do is it's a kind of a wetsuit which is wrapped around women, puts pressure on the arteries that are bleeding, and give women time to get to a higher level facility. And this has been tried and is being tested in Egypt and also in Mexico and Pakistan as well. This work, as I said, is very much in the preliminary stages, but the people using them say can buy women even up to 24 hours, certainly 5, 6, 7, 8 hours to get transported to a facility where they can get a blood transfusion, where a cesarean section can be done or other operative procedures.
But if you don't have access to skilled doctors or the right drugs because of a lack of money or transport, your chances of survival are much lower.
And colleagues have been doing work in three countries in West Africa, in Ghana, Ivory Coast, and Benin, and also in Morocco, looking at women who nearly die. And one of the interesting things they found is that for many women, and these are women who nearly died in childbirth, the delays in terms of accessing care, we found that in Ivory Coast, for example, women were having to wait 8-10 hours. Women who were coming in hospital in shock were having to wait 8-10 hours before they got a life-saving procedure, for example, for a ruptured uterus. These are women whose uteruses would have burst, again, probably because of obstructed labor. And yet they were having to wait 8-10 hours while their families rushed around trying to buy equipment and supplies and drugs. The other consequence we found, though, is that once these women leave the hospital, they have enormous bills that they have to pay. And many of them describe trying to escape from the hospitals. They sort of talked about them as if they were prisons. And work that was done by an economist at the London School showed that for some families, they were paying up to a third of their annual household income to pay for these medical complications. And these are very, very poor families. So you can imagine the devastating effect that this has on the household. And there were also women who had been divorced because, for example, their husband said, well, this is a woman who has, for example, a small pelvis, will always deliver by cesarean section, and they couldn't afford to have every delivery by cesarean section, and so they would be abandoned.
But what happens to the women who can't afford to pay for medical help? It's estimated that 5% of all pregnant women will experience an obstructed labour, where delivery of the baby is difficult for the mother. If she survives, there's a great likelihood that her child will die, and she will develop a fistula or hole between her vagina and bladder, or between her vagina and rectum. This means she will be permanently incontinent. Here's one woman's experience from Addis Ababa in Ethiopia.
She's called Agarewase, is her
name.
She was in labor for 7 days, she said. She started on Saturday and she delivered on next Sunday, she said.
እነሱ ዛሬ ነገ ተቀላቀላለች ይያሉ ልክ ሳምንት ቀዳሚ ሆነ ወደ ሆስፒታል ወደ ባህር ዳር ዘው ይሄዱ ቀዳሚ ባህር ዳር የገባው ሁር ተቀላቀልኩኝ
they thought that she will deliver. They were thinking tomorrow or after tomorrow she will deliver. And then a week passed. It was on Saturday. They took her to hospital and at Bahar Dar, she said. And there she delivered the baby in the hospital.
She was
in severe agony till Friday evening, she said. And after Friday, she doesn't know what happened. Till the baby was out. She doesn't know anything. She was unconscious, she said.
Joining me here in the studio is Gloria Essigbona, a British-born obstetric gynaecologist. Gloria, how common is this condition?
The obstetric fistula is a very common condition. It affects about 2 million women worldwide. Majority of those women are based in Africa. And in Nigeria, where I've just come back from, there are estimated to be about 100,000 women that have this condition, with 20,000 new cases added every single year. And if you sort of duplicate this among the developing world, you can see that it is a huge problem.
A huge problem. How exactly does a fistula develop?
It develops usually from obstructed labour, as you mentioned before. The baby struggles to get out. It struggles. The labour continues for days and days. Sometimes the labour can last 2 days, even as long as 7 to 14 days. You have the baby pressing to come out during that time. And it basically traps the mother's soft tissues down in the vagina between her pelvic bones. So basically you get a hole being eroded between the vagina and the bladder, or between the back passage and the bladder.
So it's quite a serious condition.
It is very serious.
You've just come back from Nigeria, where you were one of the doctors helping to repair obstetric fistulas in women there. How successful were you?
We managed in the 2-week period that we were there to operate on about 545 women, which is absolutely fantastic, considering the fact that there's a desperate lack of resources there, and that the doctors who are skilled in doing this surgery are far and few between. So to be able to do that amount of cases within 2 weeks is amazing.
What improvements will you see in a woman after you've carried out this operation?
I think it's useful to think about the woman, or the women as women who have had their lives destroyed, really. They've got bits of their life and their bodies missing. They've got a hole down below through which they leak urine continuously. And you can imagine as a woman having to put up with leaking urine all the time, and then the smell that comes from leaking urine, and sometimes feces all the time. You're not going to want, husbands are not going to want to stay around you. You're not going to want to be around your family members, and you, women find that they are outcasts. So what we attempt to do during the surgery is, of course, first of all, primarily try and close that hole that has developed down below. And it can be very simple, just putting in stitches and basically covering the defect. And after a few weeks of having a catheter in, usually the hole closes permanently and the woman is cured. But it goes a lot deeper than that, in the sense that this woman now has her life back. Women that have been divorced in the past, 60 to 70% of these women are divorced from their husbands because of the fact that they are incontinent all of the time. They find that they can either go back to their husbands or even get remarried again, and they can be reintegrated into the community. So it goes a lot deeper than just closing a hole. You're trying to think of the woman holistically as a whole package and trying to reintegrate her into the community.
How hopeful are you that women won't have to face this risk in the future?
I think one has to have hope, because if there's no hope, there's nothing really. Working in the UK and seeing women having successful pregnancies, to go to Africa or the developing world and see women just desperate there with dead babies, 95% of their babies die during childbirth, you have to have hope that yes, things can improve and things can get better. And what has been really great about this campaign organised by the UNFPA and its development partners such as Virgin Unite is that we have been able to raise awareness, and we have seen that things can be done if people do put the resources and effort in.
So hopefully for women in the future in these parts of the world, things will be better.
I hope so.
Okay, thank you very much, Gloria.
Okay.
You're listening to Health Matters on the BBC World Service, and I'm Katie Knapman. In sub-Saharan Africa, public health campaigns tend to focus on HIV/AIDS, and rightly so. But in the effort to treat those infected with the virus, have other diseases been overlooked? David Mabey is Professor of Communicable Diseases at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and he's taken a keen interest in another sexually transmitted disease, syphilis. Paula McGrath asked him about the extent of the problem.
Overall, in sub-Saharan Africa, 8% of pregnant women have syphilis. And a recent study published last year looked at how many of those were actually screened. And it seems to be about 30% overall. So every year in Africa, about 2 million pregnant women 2 million women with syphilis become pregnant. And the result of this, given that only 30% of them are screened, is that about 500,000, about 500,000 babies die of syphilis, either in the womb or shortly after delivery.
Why do they die? What actually happens? What does the
They get infected do? By the mother in the late stages of pregnancy. And depending on when the mother got infected, if it was a long time ago, the chance is low. If it was recently, the chance is high. So the baby either dies in the womb or is infected in the womb and is ill when it's born.
And can anything be done to prevent this?
It's one of the easiest things to prevent and cheapest. So it's just a case of screening pregnant women for syphilis with a blood test that costs a few pence, and treating the woman with one dose of penicillin.
And would she normally have blood taken? I mean, is that quite a routine thing in most African countries now?
In most African countries, it's policy to screen pregnant women for syphilis, as it is indeed in most European and other countries. but in practice it just isn't happening. Or it is happening in some centres in urban areas, but as I said, this recent study suggested that in 70% of cases women are not screened, even though it's cheap and treatment is extremely effective and cheap. It's a matter of a few pence per woman treated. And given the amount of lives this would save, it makes it one of the most cost-effective health interventions.
Why do you think it doesn't happen? What's going wrong?
I think it's partly because syphilis, you know, it's a stigmatized disease. It's a sexually transmitted disease. It shouldn't occur to nice people, in many people's view. The same as HIV, of course. But HIV obviously has had a lot of publicity and a lot of money put into treatment of HIV, and also into preventing mothers from infecting their babies by treating them at around the time of delivery. But in many of these programs, in spite of the fact that blood is taken from the mother, it's not screened for syphilis, because that has simply been overlooked in the rush to provide HIV treatment.
It seems really tragic. It just seems like a total waste, doesn't it?
Well, it is. It's a really tragic and absurd situation that you can have a baby born to a mother with HIV who was screened in pregnancy, treated with antiviral drugs, the baby is born free of HIV and then dies of syphilis. And we know of examples of that happening.
Would she know that she had syphilis?
No, she would probably have no symptoms at all and probably may never have had symptoms. The old screening test, the one that's normally used, it's very cheap, but it requires a certain amount of expertise to do it, and it needs to be kept cold, so you need a fridge, and you need some basic lab equipment. So it's difficult to do where you don't have electricity, but there are now newer tests which simply involve a dipstick. So you just get the blood, you put it on a dipstick, and it will tell you within a few minutes if that woman has syphilis. Even in the most rural health centre in Africa, these could be used.
David may be on one of the neglected areas of mother's health. That's all for this week's Health Matters. Next week, we'll be hearing about mother's health after birth, including a support group for women with postnatal depression in Uganda.